It's WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. A couple of weeks ago on Fresh Air, one of our guests was Dr. Raymond McNally, who's the author of the 1972 bestseller In Search of Dracula. And for over a decade, he's been researching the Dracula folklore. When he was on the show, he mentioned that one of the largest repositories of information on Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, was here in Philadelphia at the Rosenbach Museum and Library. Shortly after he was on the show, a listener called up and told us that an English writer was in town to research Bram Stoker at the Rosenbach, and we got in touch, and with me now is that author, Dr. Clive Leatherdale, who's working on a book that is supposed to come out next spring. The working title for that book is Dracula, the Novel and the Legend. He's researching vampire folklore and the life and work of Bram Stoker. He's been studying the novel Dracula in terms of Freudian theory as a Christian parable and in terms of its social and political commentary. Clive Leatherdale has written a number of other books, including Britain and Saudi Arabia, 1925 to 1939, The Imperial Oasis. He teaches international relations and popular culture at Aberdeen University in Scotland. Clive Leatherdale traveled to Transylvania last year to do research for his book on Dracula. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Good afternoon, Terry.
Why are you interested in vampire folklore?
I think basically because I regard Dracula the novel as one of the most exciting pieces of 19th century fiction ever encountered. I read it first as a teenager, and it made a great impression on me then, and it continues to do so now. And from that has stemmed my interest in vampires and werewolves and so on.
The vampire legends that we're familiar with derive mostly from Eastern Europe.
Yes.
There's a lot of Christian imagery.
Yes.
In those stories.
Yes.
Why do you think that there's so much Christian imagery in the vampire folklore?
Largely because that in the hands of the Orthodox and Catholic churches, the vampire became a weapon to impose strict belief on anybody who was wavering in their faith. Vampirism, I should say, historically goes back as perhaps the oldest legend in the world. It does so because of two basic premises. Firstly, it's the matter of death. Secondly, it's the matter of blood. The question of death is that people in all ages, from our own age back in centuries past, have always felt that death is never the end of everything. It's in fact a prelude to another form of existence. And this universal belief that there's in fact a life after death is one of the basic premises of vampirism. The second premise is the matter of blood. From time immemorial, blood has had a very mystical relationship to man's belief in the hereafter, and in fact his belief in everything. That even when man had no notion of bacteria or viruses or anything else that could kill, he soon realized by a very basic observation that whether by a laceration of the skin, a wound in battle or whatever, that loss of blood would kill. And therefore a very basic logical point arose that if loss of blood could kill, to the primitive imagination, consumption of blood could restore, rejuvenate, revitalize, and so on. And from those two basic premises, the belief in the magic of blood and the belief that death is not the end of life but the beginning of a new life, the whole fusion of the vampire legend began. So you consume blood, therefore to retain new life. That's the basic principle of vampirism. Now, those particular legends have been found the world over. The Malaysians had a peculiar creature called a Penanggalan, which had Charles Darwin known about it, would have furnished a basic plank in his principle of natural selection. The Penanggalan was simply a head and stomach zooming around the air, sucking blood from people, usually from pregnant mothers, I don't know why. And this is one of the most elaborate myths from the Malaysian peninsula. But they take different forms throughout the world. The form in Europe is largely, and this is the tradition which Bram Stoker and other writers on vampirism built upon, is largely a product of the 15th century and 16th century onwards, and is a reflection of the what you could call the Christian schism between the Orthodox and the Catholic faith, which spread out from Europe in the 15th century onwards. Strangely, this schism passed straight through an area, what we now call as Transylvania. So a lot of people actually think that Transylvania is a mythical land, rather like Ruritania, but in fact it is a part of Romania. and the poor people in Transylvania found themselves initially Orthodox, then conquered by Hungarian Catholics, then found themselves under the oppressors of the Turkish Islam, and then back again. And these people had their beliefs constantly toing and froing, with, in those times, unfortunately, methods of persuasion were not always rational. And a great many people found themselves being condemned spiritually to an everlasting life as a vampire should they have the wrong belief.
The church, during the period of vampire folklore, took vampirism very seriously.
Yes,
there was even a book called the Malleus Maleficarum, which was commissioned by the Pope to study vampirism and the succubus and incubus and witches. What did the people who write the book conclude about the existence of vampires?
Yes, the Malleus Maleficarum has become known amongst, I suppose, historians of Christianity and historians of the occult as one of the most notorious documents ever written. In fact, I should say books, not document. It's quite a substantial volume, which I happened to consult in the British Library some 6 months ago. And it literally makes your hair stand on end. And it's little wonder that the Catholic Church today do not recognize the publication of this volume. It's not in any of the Catholic encyclopedias at all. It was commissioned by Pope Innocent VIII to give two Dominican friars the responsibility for looking at all those possible heretics, werewolves, vampires. These were the fates that awaited people who were to be called heretics in that particular period, incubi and succubi as well. It was a period when the Catholic Church was under grave threat, internally and externally, the rise of Protestantism and so on. And this gave rise to the great extremes of punishment and belief. The Malleus Maleficarum has also been considered one of the most damning indictments of women. Its position on women is quite unequivocal. It labels women as a source of all sin, all man's sexual problems are derived from women, and so on. And because of this, this sort of tradition has found its way through. Bram Stoker was certainly influenced by it, and a great many, of course, 19th century novelists in general were writing about women in these terms, that they are either they are demons from the pits of hell, as the Malleus Maleficarum described, or alternatively, they're rather like the Virgin Mary, in other words, blessed beyond belief. There's no middle ground. Women are either perfect or demons.
And what did conclude about vampires, about how someone became vampire? Did it present any evidence that there were, in fact, vampires?
No, of course, there's no evidence as such as we would understand it. The basic composition of this volume is a very long question and answer syndrome, whereby you lay down your list of credentials whereby you become an incubi or a succubi. And the second half of this volume goes elaborately through all the mechanisms which you must use to try vampires and the various tortures which you must impose to get them to confess and so on.
Were there vampire hunts that were the equivalent of, say, the witch hunts?
The difference between vampires and witchcraft is very interesting in this connection. Part of the Catholic belief in vampires has to do with the notion of purgatory, that the vampires are simply people in this netherworld who are coming back to serve their time. Because the Protestant tradition dispensed with the notion of purgatory, it had to have a rather different fundamental look at what vampires were. And so the Protestant tradition tended to subsume vampires under this broad category of witchcraft, whereas the Catholic tradition, because of the notion of purgatory, had a different and separate tradition of vampires. And because of this difference, Britain, which was a Protestant country, had its witchcraft epidemics from the 16th, 17th and 18th century, and was largely immune to the vampire epidemics, which remained part of the continental folklore.
Religion was one way to ward off the vampire because a cross would keep the vampire at bay. You suggest that the threat of becoming a vampire yourself was used as a threat by the church, as a weapon to keep people in line to make sure that they were religious, because if they weren't, then they might become the prey of the vampire.
Yeah, yes. Largely, you could become a vampire by any one of millions of methods. The pagan tradition is remarkable. It's also fascinating to look at. You could become a vampire for allowing a wolf to step over somebody's grave. You could be a vampire because of a cleft palate. You could be a vampire if your head was enveloped in a caul when you were born. You could become a vampire for any one of thousands of reasons, purely superstition. With the Christian tradition, you got all kinds of biblical and quasi-Christian imagery shaping what was to become a vampire. In these early centuries of the Christian vampire notion, by which we're talking of the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, you could become a vampire, allegedly, by being born on Christmas Day. Because if you were born on Christmas Day, this presumably meant that your mother and father were engaged on base earthly pleasures at the time of the conception of Jesus Christ. And such was the logic that could determine that you would become a vampire. Those born with red hair, for example, were supposed to imitate Judas and Cain, who were also thought to have red hair, and they were destined to become vampires. And eventually, almost any attribute whatsoever, as this paranoia spread amongst much of Central and Eastern Europe, you could become a vampire for literally anything whatsoever.
So do you have any examples in any of the literature that you found of how vampirism was used as a way to keep people in line, so to speak?
Yes. The pioneer in this kind of research was a French Catholic scholar by the name of Calme, who wrote early in the 18th century on his investigations of the trials of vampires. There wouldn't be any such thing as a formal training procedure for Catholic priests to go hunting vampires, but what you would have was the natural fear and the natural recourse to your local priesthood, firstly because he had a hotline to heaven anyway, and secondly because he had the sole use of Christian implements, the cross, the rosary, and so on. Only he could possibly get rid of vampires. And the important thing was, it's a matter of evidence. You couldn't just come across a vampire generally and dispose of it, because then there would be no proof of God's power in destroying it. Therefore, you had to summon the priest, and then his destruction of it, supposedly, of course, reinforces the peasant mentality in the awesome power of Christ over the vampire, because the priest was shown to have the power to destroy it.
You visited Transylvania earlier this year, I think. Did you find that there was still much of a vampire legend in that area?
They deny it, but it's like people saying, well, I'm not actually superstitious, but I wouldn't walk under the ladder. That's the kind of attitude you get. I might say that it alters your whole opinion of Transylvania once you've been there, that I followed in the route of Jonathan Harker, which was one of the major characters in Dracula, and on one occasion, for a piece of pure bravado, a friend and myself walked down the Borgo Pass, which is where Dracula's castle was near, at midnight. And we found a small Orthodox church on the top of the hill. And we walked up to the top of this church. And at midnight, there were these graves sort of looming out of the shadows. And there was a full moon, and the clouds drifted away from the moon, and everything was illuminated. And at that moment, the wolves started. And they may have been 6 miles away, but they sounded 6 yards away. And that gave me the feel. It sort of went straight through the bones.
So you got to see how people could...
You could see it. You could feel it in the atmosphere there, yes.
Let's talk some more about some of the religious imagery in vampire folklore. You point out that there's a lot of blood imagery in both the Old and the New Testament, which ties into beliefs in vampirism. Can you give some examples?
Yes. The major religious character in the novel Dracula is a chap called Renfield. And he is strangely, he's one of the most realistic of the characters, in the sense that he's painted more vividly than the other characters in Dracula. And his slogan is, "The blood is the life." He goes around taking this expression literally, meaning that the consumption of blood will give eternal life. It's not surprising that Christian communities in Europe in these early modern times would believe in vampires and that, because the notion the blood is the life. Transubstantiation. Catholics today, of course, drink what is the blood and the body of Christ in the belief that it gives them a closer link to Christ and the possibility of eternal life. So it's not surprising that people less sophisticated than ourselves would take this far more literally. Unfortunately, the whole question of the notion of blood in biblical terms is extremely complex. Theologians today are still arguing about what the purpose of blood actually means. Is it used in a rejuvenating, holy sense, or is it used purely in a pagan, sacrificial sense in the Bible? Bram Stoker's use of it deliberately oversimplifies, because he can't get involved in this kind of theological debate, but so that when his character Renfield is saying the blood is the life, and he takes this quite literally, he then sort of swallows flies for the life that they can give him. He then feeds his flies to spiders and eats spiders for the accumulated life that can give him. And then he feeds his spiders to birds because of even more life, and he actually tries to get hold of a cat as well. So he takes this very, very literally indeed, and ignores what many theologians would say is the more prohibitive view of blood drinking in the Bible. There are numerous passages, for example, saying that thou shalt not drink the blood because of the very pagan connotations, sacrificial connotations that it has.
Clive Leatherdale is my guest, and he's writing a book about Dracula, the Bram Stoker novel. You point out that vampires were introduced to Western Europe not through the spread of the folklore, but through literature.
Yes.
Why do you think the folklore didn't spread that far?
Largely, I think, because the points I made earlier, that vampirism in its Christian manifestation was largely a reflection of the Orthodox Christian view of folklore. And the influence on folklore, that because Britain was a Protestant land, largely Protestant land, and of course as well the major epidemic, which perhaps I'll talk about later, the major epidemic of vampirism on the continent was in the 1720s. This was the era when vampire plague seemed to spread like wildfire uncontrollably. And a great deal of serious academics looked very closely at these supposed academics and didn't tend to dismiss them at all. This was the age of the Enlightenment, or coming up to the age of the Enlightenment, when German academia spent a great deal of time and energy looking into the manifestation of the vampire in Eastern Europe. And many of the prestigious universities of Germany, Leipzig, Jena, were turning out learned dissertations trying to account for what this extraordinary phenomenon which is reaching them from the east of Europe. Now, when it got to the English Channel, when this information spread westwards, of course, it met with the sceptical Enlightenment. It met with a Protestant culture would have no truck with this kind of belief. So it needed some other medium for vampire expression in order to cross the English Channel. And it received this new medium through prose, verse and poetry and prose. And the very first German poets to take an interest in this were Goethe's Bride of Corinth, is a metaphorical use of the vampire. Ossenfelder wrote a work called The Vampire as well. And gradually these influences crossed the English Channel through the influence and the erudition of German poetry rather than pure folklore. And the very first mention of the vampire in English poetry is in Robert Southey's poem Thalaba the Destroyer in the 1790s, I think, 1790s. And thereafter, the romantic poets in general, Byron, Keats, Shelley, they were all dealing with the vampire imagery. Some used the word vampire explicitly, some used it metaphorically. And it was only a matter of time before the poetic use of the vampire spread into the prose variation of the vampire. And the first indication of the vampire in prose in English literature was in John Polidori's short work, The Vampire. It's one of those curious literary coincidences that those two great 19th century myths, Frankenstein and Dracula, had the same seed, that in Geneva in around about 1820, somewhere about this period, Shelley and Byron were sort of reminiscing and decided to write a horror writing contest. Byron's travelling physician and general companion was a chap called John Polidori. He went away and wrote a short work called The Vampire. And Shelley's wife-to-be, Mary, went away and wrote Frankenstein. And now to this one evening's chat, if you like, came the two great myths of 19th century supernatural fiction. And the importance of John Polidori's short work, The Vampire, is it completely changes the vampire of folklore. The vampire of folklore metamorphosizes completely. If you look through folklore anthologies, you'll find that the vampire is squalid. He comes from the poorer, more superstitious communities. Therefore, he's gaunt, scabby, dirty, filthy. There's nothing erotic about the vampire of folklore whatsoever. But in the hands of the romantic poets, in the hands of the 19th century novelists, there was potential, and the potential stemmed largely from the belief that vampirism could be used not literally as a hideous, blood-sucking creature come to suck blood, but in a more metaphorical way to try and analyse that strange human phenomena whereby one human being can gain energy, vitality at the expense of another. Lovers, for example, one person may often gain spiritual energy by the love of another person, or domination is another example from this. And so in the hands of the Romantic and 19th century writers and poets, vampirism took on a completely different complexion from what it was previously. And throughout the 19th century, from John Polidori onwards, it explored new avenues until it finally reached the zenith of its career with Bram Stoker's Dracula in 1897.
You've been studying Bram Stoker's papers. Do you have any idea why he wanted to write a novel about a vampire?
Bram Stoker wrote eventually, I think, some 18 or 19 books. He is remembered solely for his horror writing attributes, although only four of those books were horror books. Around 10 were slushy romances of the most awful kind, which are deservedly forgotten. He wrote fairy tales, which were some of the most inspired. This was his first ever work, was a bunch of fairy tales called Under the Sunset, which, if you think back to what the 19th century authors were often writing about fairy tales, they were often more macabre and gruesome than the horror tales of the 20th century. You only have to think back to the works of Grimm and Hans Andersen. And if you think of the endings of some of the fairy tales, Cinderella and so on, these are pretty gruesome indeed. And Bram Stoker's fairy tales were in this mould, ostensibly written for children, but they dealt with themes of life after death, the quest for truth, women coming back to haunt lovers, and so on. He was, it is now known, absolutely steeped in supernatural fiction. One of the great beauties of Dracula as a novel is it is quite clear as soon as you open it that this is not a 10-minute work written by someone in a flash of inspiration to make money. He wrote it it took 6 years to write, and he wrote it in his 40s. And you can see on every page the knowledge of this man spilling forth, his knowledge on folklore, his knowledge on the occult. The plot is extremely deep. And Egyptology was a particular interest of Bram Stoker. His early years in Ireland, before he moved to London when he was 30, was spent largely delving into Irish folklore, which is one of the most complex of European folklores. And I think this is an important point to stress, that the Irish folklore tradition has inspired many an Irish author. Being on the western extremity of Europe, Ireland escaped the formal occupation of the Romans. It therefore escaped that classical imprint in the mythology that much of Western Europe would take because of its Roman imprint. And yet, as in the same way as the ripple effect of a pond, once those rippling folkloric effects got through to Ireland, much later than they got through to the rest of Western Europe, they persisted and mixed with and existed independently of the indigenous Irish folklore tradition, and has made it one of the most rich and exciting folklore traditions in Europe. And again, because Ireland is a largely Catholic country, I mentioned earlier that Catholic lands have always been far more susceptible to vampire belief than Protestant lands, and Ireland has a very rich heritage of vampire superstition, although it should be said these are largely divested of any macabre manifestations of the continental tradition. But the vampire was something that Bram Stoker grew up with.
How much research did he do? You said it took 6 years to write,
yes.
But were you able to trace his research?
Yes. His first full-length novel was published in 1890. That was called The Snake's Pass. It was set in Ireland and received very many favourable critical reviews. He then wrote, in the next 7 years before Dracula appeared, another five books, all the time working on Dracula. It appears now that he was inspired by this critical acclaim which greeted his first novel to write his magnum opus whenever he had time and opportunity. And it should be stressed, of course, that he was a part-time writer. His full-time work was as a theatre manager for the actor Henry Irving in London, and the only time he could write was on trains, on holidays, and so on. And the research, as I've now found through the kind consideration of your people here at the Rosenbach, shows that over these 6 years, from between 1890 and 1896, he was delving into every conceivable source of information on Transylvanian folklore, Transylvanian history. The novel is set in England, and all the places that are mentioned in the novel, Bram Stoker had been to, notebook in hand, taking copious notes so that the novel would be as meticulously authentic as you can possibly allow with a work of supernatural fiction.
The name that he used, Dracula, was the name of someone who was also known as Vlad the Impaler, who was, I think, a 16th century torturer and ruler in the Transylvania area.
Yes.
Have you been able to figure out why he chose this figure who had the name of Dracula but was horrible but wasn't a vampire as the source for the vampire in his novel?
This is a very good question, one that's often asked. It's clear from the first 2 years of Stoker's notes that, in fact, his vampire was not going to be Dracula at all. He hadn't stumbled upon this 15th century Romanian ruler. He had called his book Count Vampire, of all things, which, of course, hasn't got the ring that Dracula has. But at some stage in the early drafting of his work, his initial inclination, I should say, was to cite his vampire not in Transylvania, but further west in Styria, which is in present-day Austria. At some stage in 1892, it appears he came across in the library at Whitby in Yorkshire in England the activities of this 15th century Romanian prince called Vlad the Impaler, Vlad Dracula. And what appears to have struck him was the ambiguity of the word Dracula, which means son of the devil or son of the dragon. And although Vlad Dracula was not a blood drinker, his association with spilling of blood was so vivid that it was a very ready model for Bram Stoker to use. He, in fact, used to impale people. This was his favourite method of torture. And, of course, the way to dispose of vampires is to stake them. So there were a great many parallels that, although it took some licence with what Vlad Dracula was doing, nonetheless, you can see how it gave Bram Stoker the imagination for his fictional work, which he then started to call Dracula.
My guest is Clive Leatherdale, who is visiting Philadelphia to research the Bram Stoker papers, which are in the collection of the Rosenbach Museum and Library. He's based in Scotland, where he teaches at Aberdeen University. He teaches international affairs and popular culture, and he's writing a book about Dracula that's scheduled for publication next spring. Let's talk about some of the imagery that Stoker uses. As you pointed out, it's a Victorian novel. You write in your manuscript that Dracula is a fusion of contempt for women, adulation of them, and an overdose of female sexuality.
Yes.
You want to explain what you mean by that?
Yes. I should say that those three interpretations are, interestingly enough, the interpretations of three different feminist scholars, which shows, I think, just how flexible Bram Stoker's use of women can be. One feminist scholar has identified Stoker as a fellow feminist, a fellow writer seeking the liberation of women. Another sees him as simply putting women firmly in their place in the mainstream tradition of 19th century fiction. Bram Stoker's novel Dracula centres on two women, both of whom Bram Stoker paints as an idealistic picture. These are the Virgin Mary reincarnated. They are absolute heaven on earth. On closer reading, it's quite clear that they are not quite so pure as he would like to believe. The first woman, Lucy Westenra, 19, beautiful, privileged, never had to lift a finger in her life. She has men fawning all over her, and Bram Stoker somehow feels is to be worthy of her. Lucy is important in the novel because she's the first one to become a vampire. She dies, is resurrected by Dracula as a vampire, and then you see Bram Stoker's attitude to this woman change. When she was alive, he worships her through the menfolk, his male characters who worshipped her. She was worshipped because she was pure, she's had no thought of evil in her life, and she's the absolute perfect partner for any proper deserving male. Once she's resurrected as a vampire, all her pure qualities are transformed into voluptuous, carnal sexuality. And this is not painted in an enticing, erotic way, but in a violent, sexual way, which is not meant to appeal, but to appall. The expressions on the male characters' faces when Lucy appears in the cemetery in London is one of outraged horror. And you can see in the way that the bright ruby red lips with the fresh blood of the child which she has sucked, the way she's wearing the white flowing shroud, which again is so opposed to the tight-fitting corsets, which of course Victorian women had to wear. Even the imagery of her changes. When she's described in her life, Bram Stoker describes her as having sunny ripples to her hair. When she's resurrected as a vampire, she has dark raven black hair. And you can see Bram Stoker using this very old, traditional light-dark conflict. The second woman is the woman Mina. You could say the novel, in fact some critics have said, that the novel is simply told twice. The first is the life and death and resurrection and then destruction of Lucy. And the second half of the novel is when the same thing almost happens to Mina. This time, however, the male characters are forewarned. They have the experience of Lucy to fall back on, and they are able to protect Mina. Mina is quite clearly Bram Stoker's ideal partner in his conscious sense, where Lucy had been his ideal partner in her voluptuous appearance in his subconscious sense. Mina is totally sexless. She has no sexual feeling. Although she's married in the book, the sexual relationship she has with her husband has no mention whatsoever. But as soon as Dracula gets hold of her, you can see Bram Stoker exploring the torment which she is experiencing, this pure Christian woman trying to fight off these erotic undercurrents which Dracula is trying to awaken in her.
Why do you think that in the Bram Stoker novel, Dracula is erotic and well-dressed, yeah, as compared to the scab-covered,
yes,
sewage-smelling,
yes,
beast that you describe from the Eastern European folklore?
The simple answer to that, Terry, is he's not described as that. That is the invention of the cinema. Nowhere in the novel is Dracula described in the language which you've just described. He stinks. He still sleeps on beds of earth from his native Transylvania. Everyone who comes into contact with him experiences this sensation of nausea. His tombs are usually in ancient cobweb-infested chapels and so on. What he does have, however, is power. It is power and the ability to use hypnotic power over his female victims. His victims are always female in the novel. And the erotic awakening comes from the women themselves. It is never anything which comes from Dracula. You could almost say that Dracula, to use the expression of one writer, is sexually paralyzed from the neck down. Dracula operates with his teeth only at a purely oral stage. But the idea that Count Dracula is this swooning, heart-stopping, handsome aristocrat is a pure invention of the cinema.
What would you say were the themes of Victorian sexuality that are expressed through the novel Dracula?
Well, Victorian sexuality could never be expressed openly. It's something that could only be expressed surreptitiously and if it was effectively camouflaged. And it's quite clear that Bram Stoker camouflaged the sexuality of Dracula very effectively. because not only did the readers at the time not overtly recognise sexuality, but when you look back at the reviews of the book in 1897, not a single reviewer, although they all questioned its violence and the supernatural element, not a single reviewer makes a word of comment that this is a sexual, erotic book likely to despoil the morals of Victorian England.
It's interesting that the Christian imagery of the Eastern European folklore and the sexual beneath the surface imagery of Victorian England come together in the Bram Stoker telling of it. Because, I mean, you don't have that kind of implicit eroticism in any of the Eastern European folklore, do you?
That's right, no. The 19th century version of the vampire in British literature had got increasingly erotic, whilst never expressly mentioning it as erotic. And Bram Stoker's novel is, you could say, the peak of this tradition. He fuses the folklore. I should say that one of the strengths of Dracula as a creative work is that it fuses in this personality of Count Dracula the squalid vampire of folklore plus the aristocratic vampire of Western literature, plus the historical blood-spilling of Vlad Tepes. And you see this composite picture from so many different sources which Bram Stoker fused into this one character.
You mentioned that in the novel only women are the victims of the vampire. And we were talking before about blood imagery in the Old and the New Testament. Yes. Well, for a woman there's always blood imagery and menstruation.
Yes.
Do you think that menstruation plays any role in the Victorian interpretation of vampirism?
I could answer that in the sense of Dracula rather than in Victorian literature generally. One of the extraordinary passages of Dracula, which I've looked at many times, is that in the bites of the vampire, in the bites of Dracula and his other vampires, you get what you might expect. You get twin puncture marks, the two canine teeth penetrating the skin. When Count Dracula assaults, or should I say seduces or initiates, Mina, who is the heroine of the book, Bram Stoker's description of the wound left by Dracula changes completely. After Dracula has bitten her, she does not bear two puncture marks an inch or so apart. She bears a thin, open slit. And it's an extraordinary way to describe this wound. And you can, if you follow the sexual imagery further, and if you follow the notion that Mina is in fact against her better judgment experiencing sexual pleasure or erotic pleasure for the first time in her life, then you might be able to suggest that she was enjoying or benefiting from what was a form of Victorian calendar liberation, in that she had no fear of pregnancy because she is able to be aroused by Dracula at the time of her period. I accept, of course, this is pure speculation, but what is not speculation is the way Bram Stoker, for no apparent reason, chooses this graphic description of a vampire wound, quite unlike what he does previously.
There's a lot of sexual and Freudian interpretation of the novel. And you do both those interpretations in your forthcoming book. If you believe in that in those interpretations, do you think that Stoker was consciously striving for that? That he himself was thinking of the eroticism in this? Or do you think that it was something unconscious?
This, I think, is one of the most important questions, and it's one of those questions that no two scholars can really agree on. You have two completely contrasting points of view. One point of view is that Bram Stoker shows himself everywhere else in the book to be so totally in command of his material. He's so totally in control of his vampires, his folklore, his occultism, his Christian knowledge and such, that it seems rather implausible to think he's not aware of the sexual element. On the other hand, you have the history of the man. You have a man who, from all accounts, from his other memoirs, is an extraordinarily repressed individual. In the last years of his life, 9 years after Dracula was published, he wrote an article calling for the censorship of fiction, where he becomes almost hysterical, rather like a religious preacher, condemning the sexual titillation which is pouring forth in the pulp fiction of his contemporaries. And the language used in this would lead you to suggest, and it certainly leads me to suggest, that the erotic element of Dracula is much more unconscious on Stoker's part than conscious.
Another interesting difference between the Eastern European folklore and the story as it emerged in English literature is that in the Eastern European folklore, it was the peasants who largely believed in and feared the vampires. And you described Dracula as being a very middle-class novel. We're running out of time, but can I ask you to discuss that?
That Dracula is a middle-class novel?
Yeah.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this is that the novel is not written in the first or third person. It's not a tale. It's presented in the form of piles of evidence gathered by various people to add authenticity. If one person, if your narrator, is telling tales of vampires, of course the reader can think he's off his head, he's nuts. When all the characters in the novel, in their diaries, are speaking of the same experience and interpreting it the same way, this adds authenticity. But the only people he allows to keep diaries are the middle classes. Dracula is not allowed to keep a diary. The other aristocrats in the novel are not allowed to keep a diary. There is one American in the novel, again, who is not allowed to keep a diary. So you have Stoker's own middle class position reflected and refracted through the middle class entries of the various characters in the novel. And they show complete contempt for the working classes and more or less disdain for the upper classes.
Interesting. We only have about a minute left. I know that you're a great admirer of the Bram Stoker novel. Are there any vampire movies that you're fond of?
No.
Why not?
Basically, because very often when you ask someone, have you read Dracula, they say as a reflex response, no, but I saw the movie. It's rather like saying, have you read the Bible, and hearing the response, no, but I saw Jesus Christ Superstar, that the films have no, the movies have no reflection on the book and don't do justice to the book and never can.
But you don't like them just for their own sake, just for the filming aspects of it?
Not really, because I find the book, I think the word I would want to use is profound. The book is a very profound book, and none of the movie versions can ever be profound.
Okay. Thank you a lot for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Clive Leatherdale, and I think our audience, those of you who were listening a couple of weeks ago and I was talking with Raymond McNally, might believe that there's actually a vampire scare, or why else would we be having so many interviews about vampires? But let me explain that Clive Leatherdale's in Philadelphia to research the Bram Stoker papers. Bram Stoker wrote the novel Dracula. The papers are in the collection of the Rosenbach Museum and Library. And one of our listeners who heard the interview with Raymond McNally about vampirism a few weeks ago called up to let us know that Clive Leatherdale would be in Philadelphia. He's the author of a forthcoming book, expects it to be published next spring. The working title for the book is Dracula, the Novel and the Legend. Will it be published in America?
Sure,
yes. Do you know the publisher in America?
No, that's not clear yet, no.
Okay, well, we'll look for it.
Thank you
very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on your program.
And Clive Leatherdale is a teacher at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. He teaches international relations and popular culture. And he'll be leaving Philadelphia after today he's concluded his research. It's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Now for motorists traveling home on southbound I-95, about a 15 to 20 minute delay traveling into the airport area. Northbound I-95 slowing about a quarter mile approaching the Race Street merger through Aramingo Avenue. Westbound on the Schuylkill Expressway slowing west of Montgomery Drive through the Boulevard crossover. Also a half mile approaching Route 202, an accident blocking the left lane a three quarter of a mile back up in that area. Eastbound slowing from 202 down to a half mile east of Route 202 due to a gaper, and again a minor delay at South Street. If you're traveling in Burlington Township, a van fire being cleared up southbound on 295 and just approaching Route 541. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Jim Battelis.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Club Chow. A reminder about the Jubilee of Prizes, you can win a Caribbean cruise for two on the SS Norway from Norwegian Caribbean Lines. It's one of 91 prizes in the WHYY Jubilee of Prizes, a sweepstakes to benefit 91 FM and TV12. To enter, return the tickets and entry card found in the bright red Jubilee of Prizes packet. If you haven't received one but would like to enter, send a postcard to WHYY Jubilee of Prizes, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. Or you can pick one up at Cass Electronics Distributors, 2502 Township Line Road in Drexel Hill. All entries must be received by June 25th for the July 4th drawing. Underwriting for the WHYY Jubilee of Prizes has been provided by SmithKline Beckman Corporation. Well, tomorrow is Flag Day, and we will be featuring a special Flag Day program at 3 o'clock produced by Charles Hardy, who also did the popular culture show and the oral history series I Remember When. Well, this show will be Betsy Ross, Mother of Our Country, Charles Hardy's documentary analyzing the history and the myth of Betsy Ross. And at 3:40, Bob Carlin hosts The Record Ranch, a roundup of new traditional and ethnic recordings. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Bill Lee, former pitcher for the Boston Red Sox and the Montreal Expos, and author of a new memoir titled The Wrong Stuff. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on The Best of Fresh Air, we'll take a look at Class in America with Paul Fussell, author of Class, A Guide Through the American Status System, and Joan Crone, author of Home Psych, The Social Psychology of Home and Decorations. I hope you can be listening. Ken Tucker contributed to today's program. Production assistance contributed by Jeff Foreman. Jay Goldman was the technical director. Maeve McGoran is the associate producer of the program. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a terrific evening. All Things Considered is coming up from National Public Radio, and you're tuned to listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley, WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
Police have been forced to fight a losing battle, like trying to rid an area of mosquitoes by
swatting
them.
There's more police, more light on 42nd Street than any place else in the United States.
Two views of Manhattan's most notorious street. The city's planning to rebuild Times Square. Tonight on All Things Considered, we explore New York's Forbidden Zone.
And these stories, the date is set for the execution of Velma Barfield, the first woman to be put to death in this country since 1962.
The Secretary of State calls for laws to protect U.S. diplomats from terrorism.
In Brazil, the film industry flourishes again.
Bob Woodward on the fast, short life of John Belushi.
That and more, now this news.
This is Brian Naylor. The House continues to debate an immigration control bill, today approving an amendment penalizing employers who knowingly hire illegal aliens. It is not now against the law to hire a person who crosses the border illegally. Sponsors of the proposal argued the penalties would deter employers from hiring illegals and thereby stem the flow of undocumented workers into the U.S. Earlier today, a member of the House Hispanic Caucus, Representative Robert Garcia of New York, said his group appears